as opposed to using this as an opportunity to discuss your views about the war. With that, I will pass it off to Mr. Borden, if you have any comments you would like to make, or should we bring them on up?
Chair Shields, I think that there are no comments we'd like to make except to note that this is probably the last day for public hearing, and we'll plan work session for the agency in a month or so, as soon as all the other agencies have finished with their public hearing. So, thank you.
Great. With that, General Reese, would you like to please come forward?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Major General Fred Reese, the Adjutant General for Oregon. I'm accompanied today by Colonel Scott McCray, retired, with the Oregon National Guard Reintegration Team and its team members. We also have Dr. Jim Sardo from the Portland Veterans Affairs Medical Center and Mr. Jim Willis, the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, to be available to discuss post-traumatic stress disorder. I would also like to express the gratitude on behalf of Oregon's soldiers and airmen and their families to this body for its work on the legislative activity directly related to the Oregon National Guard and military personnel. I apologize to the committee for my absence at previous hearings. I am confident that Mike Caldwell and others have represented our agency well. I've served in the Oregon National Guard for 34 years, and I marvel every day at the competence, the confidence, the courage, and the commitment of all our National Guard soldiers and airmen. The events of the last 5 years have made a good thing better. We have sharpened our skills in the National Guard, our processes as individuals and as an institution. On the other hand, we have some serious shortfalls, and I believe Mike Caldwell has talked with you in great detail about our daunting equipment shortfalls. The federal government is responsible to acquire, distribute, and replace the equipment. It is infuriating to have our thousands of veterans who know what right looks like and our new recruits walk into an armory or a motor pool and essentially find they have 30 to 40% of the equipment that they need. Likewise, it makes us mad to see that these same soldiers walk into a dilapidated 60-year-old armory and try to convince them that they are part of the 21st century military. Part of that issue is federal replacement armories. But until that process is accelerated, we will have facilities at the bottom of the priority list that will only be fixed if the state will step forward and cost share their renovation. It is the single most substantive thing that you can do for our budget with a direct and immediate impact on the morale and welfare of those soldiers, the quality of life and workplace for those soldiers. On a different tack, I am confident you will see the wisdom of supporting our role with the Office of Emergency Management and Emergency Response. We have the skilled force. We are working to improve our equipment position. We are working to improve armories as a significant base of operations for disaster response, and your help in assuring they are fully capable would be significant. Likewise, funding those positions that enable us to communicate with the public in emergency response or pre-disaster education would be a wise investment. Our presentation this afternoon will be on our reintegration program, followed by a discussion on post-traumatic stress disorder. In your presentation notebooks, you'll find a tabbed index on reintegration. The Oregon National Guard Reintegration Program was established in 2005, mainly in response to a critical need arising from Oregon citizen soldiers and airmen returning from long-term war zone deployments. These returning soldiers and airmen require assistance reintegrating back into civilian life, whether it be pay issues, finding jobs, applying for veterans assistance, or emotional support during the transition back to civilian lives. This valuable program is available 24/7 and provides a central clearinghouse to our National Guard members, pointing them towards all available avenues for assistance. Being in the Guard themselves or retired from the Guard, this team is viewed as more approachable than most government agencies. On several occasions, they have responded to soldiers experiencing post-traumatic stress. In addition to the support of our elected officials, we are also on the receiving end of a great deal of community support, particularly for our veterans returning from operations Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom. Companies such as Platt Electric and United Rentals have provided dozens of job opportunities for our troops. Recently, I signed a memorandum of understanding between the Oregon State Apprentice Training Council and the Oregon National Guard. This arrangement will provide preference to our soldiers and airmen in apprentice placement and training towards apprenticeship. It could reduce the time necessary to reach the journeyman level. I would now like to turn over the microphone to Colonel McCray and the reintegration team, followed by Dr. Sardo and Mr. Willis. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Colonel Retired Scott McRae. I joined the Oregon Army National Guard in 1970 and retired in 2004. So almost 35 years with the Oregon Guard. And a couple things I want to say up front is that this is probably the best program we've had for taking care of our soldiers and our citizens since I was ever in the Guard. So it's a good program, and the support we have had from elected officials to state agencies, federal agencies, and all organizations has been nothing but outstanding. So just wanted to say that up front. What I have with me to get today, some of the members of my team, and this is Sergeant First Class Vince Jocks, who will address some of the issues. Sergeant First Class Phil Moss is our, we call it Career Transition Assistance Program. I call it our jobs program. That's easier to say, jobs program. In the back, Major Dan Thompson, Chaplain Dan Thompson, is now coming in as our executive officer / operations officer, and is just transitioning in. Sergeant Heyer will come forward. He's on CBHCO, and we'll talk a little bit about its community-based healthcare organization that manages wounded soldiers when they come home from deployments. Mrs. Diane Gooding is our director of our family program in Oregon. So I just wanted to introduce some of the team members that are here today, and thank you for having us. So there's a brief agenda there, and the first slide. The reintegration program, we had to decide what we were going to do. So we developed a mission statement. Basically, it was help soldiers transition back into their communities. And then we set up some goals, and was to be able to provide 100% assistance to our soldiers. And I might caveat this, we also provide assistance to any veteran that calls us for assistance. Doesn't matter what service, whether they're retired, whether they're still active, we provide the same answer to a veteran from any service. In fact, we've just briefed the Coast Guard within the last month to tell them what we do on reintegration to help them get a program going. We work with the USAR. We work with the Marine Corps Reserve on an informal basis, but our main charter is the National Guard. The phone number there is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We don't want somebody to call on Friday afternoon at 6:30 p.m. and wait till Tuesday when somebody gets back to their messages with them. So these guys, they gracious enough to carry a cell phone with them, and that toll-free number is forwarded to one of the team members so we can answer it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
And if I could just interrupt you, I saw the number. I was doing some work on Saturday, and I thought, you know, I'm going to call to see if anybody picks up. And sure enough, on the first ring, somebody picked up.
Ah.
So I can commend you for that.
Thank you. I'll pay you afterwards. But that was our intent, was to be able to have that instant response, and so it works. And our goal is not to be subject matter experts on any specific thing. We have other people that do that. Our job is to be able to help the soldier, sailor, airman, Marine, get to the person that they need to get to for assistance. Next slide. You can see the kind of the framework. We have the soldier, the family, and the unit up there is the National Guard unit. And the reintegration team ties those entities together at post-deployment. Now, we start before they deploy. So we start a pre-deployment doing briefings, and we work during deployments to try to make sure that the information gets to the soldiers. And with the Internet now, we even have soldiers that are in Afghanistan or that were in Iraq that would actually email back and say, I'm going to be looking for a job when I get home. What are my options? And so we'll start some dialogue then. But mainly the real work starts once the soldiers return home. We do the briefings for the reintegration. And if you look at the partners there, we have a lot of partners. And I might add, it just doesn't brief well. I mean, that's not up there just to brief well. We're really on a first-name basis with most of the key agencies that we work with. And, in fact, we're generally either daily or weekly contact with a lot of members of these agencies. So it's not just something that we put up there, or it's not just something we wrote on a piece of paper to get done, a formality. It's really a working relationship. Next slide. So the reintegration program, General Reese talked about it, started and formally instituted in 2005. And we're kind of embarrassed to say that we kind of had to model it off of some soldiers from 2 of the 162, Sergeant Jocks being the key factor in the 2 of the 162, was he came home injured, and he was on the community-based healthcare organization because he'd been injured in a roadside bomb, blew up his Humvee. So he was home, and he wanted to go back to Iraq, but he couldn't because he was injured. So the next best thing to do was help his soldiers, he calls them his Joes, when they got home. So he actually started working with the Chambers of Commerce, local agencies, local officials, and tried to provide things for them when they got home. When we formally instituted our program, the first person I called was Sergeant Jocks and said, "Hey, Sergeant Jocks, why don't you come to work for us and I can give you a cell phone?" And he said, "Gee, sir, that'd save me $200 a month on my cell phone bill." So Sergeant Jocks has been key from the reintegration program from the get-go and has been here ever since. The next bullet, the CTAP program, Career Transition Assistance Program, or JOBS program, has been a real bellwether of how well we're doing. And Sergeant Moss will brief some of the particulars of the CTAP program. And the Memorandum of Understanding we initiated early on really was the VA was a real leader in this because they had worked a similar deal in Washington, although Washington's way behind us now, I can tell you that. And they helped us get the Memorandum of Understanding going. And you can see the signatories here. These are the agencies that we work with day in and day out. Jim Willis is here, the ODVA. Has been super working with them, and he really does a lot of the work. We just send him the business. The VA, the federal VA, they're certainly a big player in what we do. And the Employment Department and then the Department of Labor are just huge partners in what we do. Next slide. Here's a little bit of the team breakdown and the funding. We have two state employee positions, and I work on state money. I work part-time as the director for it, because when I retired, they said they didn't want me back full-time anymore anyway. But I have some good people, and we have one part-time in the public affairs. And if you see the Sentinel, one of our big issues right now is getting the word out. How do we let soldiers know what we have? Because we can help them. I guarantee you, we can help them or get them to somebody that can help them if we know about their issue. Problem is, a soldier not knowing that we're there and being able to come to us and say, "Where do I get help?" So that helps, and the articles in the Sentinel that you have there, I believe you have a copy of it, certainly help that. The state has stepped up and provided funding. We're the only state in the union that the state has stepped forward and provided funding for the reintegration part, and it has allowed this program to go.
We're the only state that's providing any money for reintegration? Is that what you said?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Some states are working it, but they really... We're the only state that has more than one dedicated employee for reintegration. And that person is a contract employee because the National Guard Bureau finally started coming along a little bit and decided to take it out of Hyde. And I might add that there are only about 8 to 9 states that are doing anything in the reintegration arena. So that means 40-plus states and territories are doing. The soldiers come home, they say, "Have a good life, and we'll see you at drill or we'll see you somewhere else." And unfortunately.
Right, or we'll see you when problems manifest.
Yes, sir. Yeah. And so we are with this, we are able to provide a lot of help, and I'll let Sergeant Jocks talk about some of those specific cases.
And if I could just mention, I'm very proud that the co-chair has funded the reintegration program 100% of what was requested.
Thank you. Next slide. This is just a kind of a timeline. We work with them before they go, during their deployment, and then when they come home. And we'll talk to you a little bit about the Soldier Enhancement Day. And that's where we go to a unit after they have returned and the dust is kind of settled, and that's normally 90 to 180 days after they have been released from active duty from their deployment. And we will bring VA representatives in, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs representatives. We'll bring employers in, depending on what the population is going to be of the unit that comes in. And so we will bring lots of service organizations, lots of assistants, to subject matter experts in, and employers, and we will set it up so that the soldiers have the opportunity to talk directly face-to-face with those people that most affect their lives. And, in fact, we have one coming up in, we did one in January in Medford. We're going to do another one in September after the 41st comes back, and that'll be about 90 days after they've come back. And we expect from approximately 500 soldiers to be able to have a job fair, have VA reps for mental and physical health assessments, have family assistance representatives, have TRICARE representatives there, so that we can brief them either as a group or one-on-one. And it allows us to say, here's the help you need, and they get to see it face-to-face. Next slide. What most soldiers get when they come home, they get these briefings normally at their DMOB station. And you can see here, when they get to their DMOB station, soldiers have nothing more in mind than to get home. They would mortgage their house, sell their boat, give you their boat away to you. They'd sign anything to say, if it gets me home any quicker, I'll sign it, I'll be at the briefing. And really, they don't pay much attention. So these are basically the bare bones briefing they get, and that's one of the issues, and I'll talk about it in one of our, you know, one of the issues as we get on of what we have as a possible solution to it. The reintegration program, you can see there. Next slide. We started in March of 2005. We briefed approximately 2,500 soldiers. The refrigerator magnet, I believe you got in there. We hand it to them, and we say, if nothing else, if you don't remember anything else, remember to put this on your refrigerator, and when the time comes you need assistance, call the toll-free number. And then we go back, and then we actively get engaged at the 90 to 180-day time frame. The phones, we really did a reassessment today. We actually are working more like 60 to 75 assistance calls and employment calls per week. And then if you've taken phone calls, you know that each one of those generate 4 to 10 phone calls from that one phone call. We keep busy at what we're doing. I might also add that we're geographically dispersed. We have, Sergeant Jocks works in Eugene, and he covers Eugene and Southern Oregon. Chaplain Thompson lives in Portland, and he works Portland and helps with Salem. Luke Wilson, who is our contract employee, who was also returned injured from Iraq, he works in Eastern Oregon. He's stationed out of LeGrand. So the team is geographically dispersed, and they have areas of responsibility so that they can be there face-to-face to meet with the soldiers in the units. So the call is there. I don't know who you got, but you might have got Luke Wilson. If he answered it, he was in Hermiston. So it doesn't matter where they are located. They get to share on the phone coverage, but also they then hand it off to the person that's nearest to that soldier that needs assistance. Website?
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a lot of phone calls you have to respond to. Do you keep data on the type or the category of inquiry of those phone calls? How many of them are about jobs? How many of them are about other sorts of assistance or problems?
Good question. Representative Chair. Representative Nathanson, the way we track it is we don't keep any personal data, and part of the reason is the confidentiality, because we want soldiers to feel like they can come to us, and they don't get it. It's not a report that has their name that goes to anybody else. So we keep a tracking log, and we err on the side of caution as opposed to being able to track everything that goes through. Now, we do keep track of it because we follow we want to follow up and go get back with the soldier and say, did you get the care you needed? And they also ask a soldier, if you don't get what you need, call me back. Or sometimes if you do get what you need, call me back and let me know that it's been taken care of. So we don't keep a log that we share with anybody. If Sergeant Jocks helps somebody with a mental health issue, he doesn't tell me the name of that soldier. He says, I helped somebody. He might keep track of it and call the soldier back. So I don't know if that answers your question, but we try not to keep a log where it's public record.
Follow up.
Thank you. I also wholeheartedly support your efforts to maintain confidentiality. I'm interested just in aggregate data, not in individual data. How many calls relate to mental health issues? How many calls relate to housing or jobs or those other, just in categories? What kinds of calls are coming in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, I don't have the data. I don't have it right here. We would really have to go back and Sergeant Jock sent me his book. It's kind of a log of, I was kind of, here's what I did today, or that kind of book, and after about 10 pages of stuff that he did, we haven't compiled it. We could give you a rough guess, a rough estimate of what percentage calls. Probably 50% are mental health, 40% for jobs, and the other 10% housing or emergency assistance.
That's
run in that category.
That answers it for me. It helps me. Just recall that helps me understand how important the service is, and also where additional assistance may be warranted in the future. So that's why I'm asking. Because the kind of work or effort that needs to be done to satisfy one kind of call or inquiry is different than what's needed to help in the other.
One of the things that we...
I'm sorry. Senator Westland had a question as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to apologize to our distinguished panel. I've got to go catch a phone call with Senator Wyden, which has been postponed from 1 to 2 to 3 to 3:30, hopefully for good reason, because they're on the floor voting on the extension of the timber tax receipts as we speak. They wanted me to talk to me about some guy named Caldwell, but comment and question. First of all, I cannot applaud you more for Oregon's exemplary efforts. I know we're the most progressive in the nation when it comes to reintegration. But I also want to say I've been speaking with an individual by the name of Paul Evans that has a very unique concept with regard to reintegration for some soldiers to work up to 20 hours on community projects, brush clearing, trail preparation, lots of different things. So it's something as we revisit this, I think maybe the committee can look at it a little bit more in depth. But here's my specific question. With regard to TRICARE, are any of our soldiers having difficulty gaining access because of the reimbursement rate to physicians paid by the government to these individuals that are coming home with, without injuries or even just normal, broken leg because they fell off their motorcycle?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, that's a good, great question. The short answer is yes. TRICARE pays at welfare rates.
What are welfare rates? I mean, we've got Medicare,
Medicaid. Medicare rates. So it's very low. We're still living with the stigma of, used to be Champus.
Right.
And we've broken through some of that crust. Now, TRICARE pays more on time, but they still pay very little.
Are those tied to national Medicare rates? So as if you're in Massachusetts, you're getting actually the highest rate in the nation, and yet here in Oregon, our Medicare recipients and by extension our soldiers are getting the lowest reimbursement in the nation?
That's my understanding, but I'm not an expert on TRICARE.
General Caldwell is shaking his head in affirmation. That's just one more thing I want to talk to Senator Wyden about. Excuse me.
Thank you very much. I need that
sir.
Information for
right.
this phone call.
Okay.
Please continue.
Okay. So, speaking of TRICARE and if you look at the bottom of the slide there, resource trips, we had trouble in Eastern Oregon with the 3rd Battalion, 116th Cavalry, coming home a year ago in November. Hospitals in Eastern Oregon didn't accept TRICARE. So we worked in concert with the TriWest, who is a contractor for TRICARE. We worked with them, and we made a trip to hospitals in Central and Eastern Oregon, and we were able to meet with the hospital in Hood River, the Dalles, Hermiston. It was Hermiston, LeGrand, and the one in Bend, and we were able to get them to commit to signing on to accepting TRICARE, where before they didn't. The problem we have is a lot of the doctors and civilian agencies won't necessarily accept TRICARE. So that's still an ongoing issue, especially in rural Oregon. Now, TRICARE they're changing their policy where it's available to more Guard and Reserve, and it will probably in the near future become almost an insurance of choice if somebody's in the Guard or the Reserve, because it'll be affordable to them and it will provide them some insurance. However, the pay rates are still low, and we still have to work with doctors to get them to accept TRICARE. So that is an ongoing issue. Okay, next slide. Okay, on emergency assistance and soldier assistance, I'd like Sergeant Jocks to talk about it. He works day-to-day with people. He has personally intervened, though he's not trained as a counselor and not trained as a intervention specialist. He has worked with soldiers and personally intervened in 6 potential suicide instances, in addition to any number of soldier issues dealing with whether it's mental, physical health care, education issues, or whatever. So, Sergeant Jocks?
Mr. Chair, representatives and senators, thank you for having us here. And I have to clarify something before we get going. Colonel McRae said when we were in the office it wasn't totally the phone that got me to come on and be part of the big team. It was Colonel McRae telling me that he wanted these soldiers coming back from Iraq to have what his son could never have. And his son was killed in action with our battalion. So when he said that, I said, I'm working for you. And I had to clarify that real quick. I wanted to give you guys a couple of 3 positive things that have happened. And I sat down with my wife last night, and I kind of went, hey, what are 3 of the good things? And you know, I really came up with a few, and through my mind I went, is it the one of the medics we had that came back from OIF2 that through Dr. Mullins' Samaritan Health Group was able to step on and do on-the-job training as a radiologist right off the street? Or is it the single father recently divorced with his wife going through, just hit rock bottom, and literally going off the deep side, getting him into counseling, Roseburg, 28-day program, and he's exceeding the standards now, as opposed to a few months ago, I didn't know if he was going to make it from week to week. I'd do a welfare check and, you know, go, hey, you okay? And now he's doing exceptionally well. He's exceeding the standards of what they thought he was going to do. So it's an ongoing thing with those. And then, or is it the soldier I dealt with on March 11th? I got a call from one of the lieutenants in the unit. One of her soldiers was driving down I-5 erratically, loaded weapons in the trunk of the car, self-mutilation on his arms. We were able to get a hold of the police departments and kind of steer him in the right direction and get him into the VA. And that's the place where they need to go. We've had circumstances, as you guys all have a handout. You know, I'm not real... It's I'm kind of reaching for words here, but you have the Sergeant Stout article. And that's usually that stuff is real personal, and I don't give out the information, but that one was, that's what happened with that circumstance. This circumstance, the soldier went to the VA, he was taken care of and released, and I've continuously been doing a welfare check, and last night kind of got to the bottom of things and said, what are you doing for work? Well, he's on standby 24 hours a day. Pretty stressful. Okay, well, I don't have enough money to go down for the 30-day program. Well, we do have the Oregon National Guard Emergency Relief Fund. And if a guy's in this kind of, you know, situation, that's what that money's there for. So we can cover him, get him down there, get him better, get him back out in the community, because I know what he's capable of doing. He's a wonderful man. And it kind of goes without saying with that.
Sergeant Jux, before you get any further, could you please identify yourself just for the record?
Oh, yes. Mr. Chair, my name is Sergeant First Class Jux, Oregon National Guard Reintegration Team. I came in the Army in 1990. I served 4 years as a paratrooper. I was in Desert Shield and Desert Storm. I got out of active duty in 1994, joined the Oregon National Guard from there, and I've been in since for the last 13 years. And very proud to be in the Oregon National Guard. Quite frankly, these are the best soldiers I've ever served with. And I mean that. I wouldn't be sitting here right now if it wasn't for the guys I was over there with. I kind of want to go into a brief thing of how we started in the Corvallis area. We started reaching out with the Chambers of Commerce. We made a great contact with Dr. Mullins in that area, and that's what really set things forward. One of the things that, like Colonel McRae was saying, we had a hard time with TRICARE. And one of my soldiers was up at Fort Lewis. He wasn't able to come home because there was no doctors in the area that accepted TRICARE for a hand specialist, plastic surgeon kind of thing. Well, after going around and doing a little research on our own, we found a doctor, Dr. Havard, hand specialist, and he did accept TRICARE. And so it kind of put us on the, we put our war paint on, and we started going out and making things happen. And those hospitals that signed on with TRICARE out there, every one of those we went to was a victory, because a soldier's going to get taken care of now, and they are not going to have to sit at Fort Lewis, which is, quite frankly, it was the worst 5 weeks of my military career. The doctors up there are awesome, but administrative-wise, things are getting rough, but I don't want to get too far off online there. We worked with the community colleges. They were very open-armed to us, and they still are, and we maintain that to this day. We want to keep the doors open for education. Lynn Benton Community College has a 12 free credit hours for any Lynn or Benton County resident that returns from Iraq or Afghanistan to get them back into school and get them back on their feet. And that's a true community college in my eyes, because they're accepting these soldiers back as a part of the community. And those soldiers that have gone in and used that, most of them, from what I've seen, are still in school. And it has been a tremendous success. And we're working on that with some other colleges and whatnot. I sit on one of the committees down at Southern Oregon University with Major Lee, and we're working on veterans issues with that college also, keeping the doors open, possibly making a one-stop, because there is a tremendous amount of paperwork you have to do as a veteran, and just keeping the doors open at the universities. Soldier Enhancement Days, Colonel McRae hit on that, and I don't want to steal Sergeant Moss's thunder, but they are a huge asset to the communities right now. And that's these soldiers coming back. They're not sitting behind a fence at Fort Lewis or Fort Benning, Georgia. They're members of this community. They're members of your community. We have normal jobs out there on top of being a warrior citizen. There's a lot that these guys have to offer. I've seen these soldiers. They're walking down the street. They walk by you every day. They're part of your community. I know what they're capable of. They come back from Iraq. They're survivors. They truly are survivors. But surviving there as opposed to surviving in the community are two different things. what we facilitate as part of the reintegration team is getting them back on their feet and helping them be citizens again, to where they can be as productive as they were over there, as you know, as opposed to being back here. The sky is the limit. Every one of these soldiers I dealt with over there, down to the lowest private, had the power in their hands to change the entire outcome of the war. And they performed all their duties in a professional manner, and I saw what they were capable of. So they come home, and they're able to handle that kind of responsibility, but it's a whole different type of atmosphere. So I thank you guys for having all of us here today, and I'm definitely here to answer any questions.
Thank you, Sergeant Chucks. We are very grateful for the work that you're doing on behalf of the country, on behalf of the state, and on behalf of our returning soldiers and servicemen and women. Thank you. Any questions? Okay, let's keep rolling.
Mr. Chair, Colonel McRae, I'll talk a little bit about the summit meeting that we have coming up. And with our partners, we talked about earlier, we meet every 4 to 6 months, and we bring all of our partners in, and we talk about how we can best assist the soldiers that are returning and who brings what to the table. We're going to meet again on 19th of April at the Anderson Readiness Center, where we'll use the conference room there. We invite anybody here that wants to come to join us, and we cover a lot of issues. We get a lot resolved, and we get a lot of networking done. So it has been a real benefit to us throughout the year.
And that's going to be, I think, from 9:30 to 12, if General Caldwell, if I recall correctly.
Yes, sir.
If you could please let all of the committee members know by email, that would be much appreciated.
Very good, sir. And now I'll be followed by Sergeant Moss, who will talk about our jobs program, also known as the Career Transition Assistance Program.
Great. And before we go on, I've got two people signed up to testify during the public testimony section. Is there anyone else here who has not signed up that wants to testify, just so that I can work on the timing? Okay, great. Please continue. Come on up.
Next slide, please. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
You can just pull the microphone a little closer to you.
Okay. Apologize about that. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I am Sergeant First Class Phil Moss. I'm the program manager for the Career Transition Assistance Program. It's the jobs program. Okay? We'll boil it down. I will make every attempt to be brief, Mr. Chairman. Just some real quick stats. Current employers participating, there were two that I certainly wanted to allude to. Current employers participating is no longer 156, it's now 165. And the bottom number of hires as direct referrals is no longer 190, it is now 237. The easiest way, next slide please. The easiest way that I know to sum up the jobs program is exactly that. When you look at the individual level support that we provide, whether it be assistance with resume preparation, videotaping mock job interviews, direct referrals, assisting individuals. If you've ever tried to go to usajobs.gov to register a resume, it is arguably one of the most tedious, time-consuming. If you weren't involved in VA mental health yet, by the end of that seminar, I promise you, if you don't know Dr. Sardo, you'd know him by the end of that. So one of the things that we do on the CTAP side is we have tried to go through usajobs.gov, basically any sort of a search engine out there, and set the parameters for the Pacific Northwest. So when the individual or family member goes to that site, they're going to exactly what it is they're looking for. We've alleviated a lot of the legwork for them. Next slide, please. One of our highlights happened here recently, in fact, right down the hall, was when Dan Gardner and our Adjutant General, General Reese, signed the Memorandum of Understanding with the Apprenticeship and Training Council. What this does, in a nutshell, an individual that has maybe the military occupational specialty as a carpenter, if they wanted to go into that apprenticeship program, That journeyman's license, it might take them anywhere from 36 to 48 months. What the signing of the MOU has done is it's taken that individual that is, in fact, MOS qualified and given that individual not only open enrollment capability to go into the apprenticeship program, but to get credit for the MOS training that was provided to them. So instead of a 36 or 48-month apprenticeship program, now maybe we're looking at 28 months. So when you start to look at a family wage position, just starting as an apprentice, or just starting into the apprenticeship program is already family wage, but what we are looking for is accelerating the time to that journeyman license. So that was a huge, huge deal for us. Next slide, please. If there's no questions concerning the career transition program, I'll be followed by Carl McRae. The one thing I did want to note, Mr. Chairman, there are 8 other states out there that are doing something on reintegration. There's only one Oregon. We're the only ones with a jobs program. That's it. There's not 8 other states. There's not 8 other people. We're it.
Great. Well, we thank you very much for your work.
Thank you for
your time.
It sounds
like you're having great results with the job placement and apprenticeship aspects.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, Colonel McRae. We put in some slides for the family program, and I'll just move them through them. Like I say, Diane Gooding is here as our director, but with the reintegration program, we work arm in arm with the family program. We try to get the same information to the spouses we try to get the same information to the soldiers to go to the spouses and vice versa. And I just want to, family assistance centers, we have 8 that are throughout the state, geographically located throughout the state. And we work a lot of the same issues. They work with the spouse. And a lot of our information for, I guess, being able to do assistance comes from the spouse. And so they're 2 programs that work just hand in glove with each other. So next slide. You know, if there's any questions about it, we can work it. But basically, we mirror each other. We do what we do for the soldier, what they do for the family, and vice versa. One thing, we go back, let's go on the next slide. There's a military one-source site there that is a federal site, and we use it a lot because there's counseling that's available through that site that's completely confidential, and they arrange for the counselor, so we use that site a lot also. So there are federal assets out there, but they're normally long distance. Next slide. One thing I wanted to point out is the family, the marriage enrichment, which is the top up there. It is a good program that in many cases has saved marriages. We don't have necessarily any statistics on whether how many it has or hasn't saved here, but it brings the couples together after they come home, gives them an opportunity to sit down, go through some counseling, spend some time together, and get to know each other again. So that's really a key part that we need to continue to work on. Next slide. On the gaps. Currently, by doctrine, we're authorized 10 days of DMOB time. 7 of those days are authorized at the DMOB site. So if they come to Fort Lewis, or in 41st Brigade's combat team's case coming up, Fort Stewart, Georgia, and they're authorized 7 days there and 3 days at home station. As they flow in, that 7 days and 3 days is for each group that flows in, and they flow in different chocks. So it might be 200 come in at one time, 10 hours or 15 or 20 hours later, another 200 depending on the flights coming in. So it's not, we don't have any organization to it. It's we try to manage the chaos. And it's kind of like getting people in and getting them out the door. So when they come back to Oregon, General Reese and the governor are faced with the same thing. They come back, they have 3 days. Well, Chalk 1 has 3 days, and it starts when they hit the ground here. Well, for Chalk 10, it starts 10 days later, 5 days later. It depends on whatever it is. So we have managed chaos through that period. So that's one of the things that's really, really an issue that we have as a gap. There's not a whole lot that we can do about it at the state level. There's a federal initiative right now to make that 2 weeks at home state and define the time period so that we can do some of these reintegration activities that we can't do right now. Medical issues, when a soldier has something wrong with them medically, if they want to be treated at a post, say Fort Stewart, Georgia, at the DMOB site, then they are sent to the nearest medical facility. And they'll sign off anything to come home. So they'll say, I'm fine, and come home, and they're, when they're really not. So we try to work those issues. Employment incentives for employers are minimal. We don't say, employer, Platt Electric, who's hired, I think, 37 from the military in the last year, there aren't any incentives for them to do it. If they do it, it's because they want to do it. And so incentives for employers could be a real benefit for us. And continued funding for the reintegration team, and you said it was already in there, so, you know, it's not a gap. Now it's, you know, it's not a gap. And so some of the potential solutions you'll see there, a lot of them are at the federal level. Really isn't any effect that we can do at the state level, isn't any effect we can do at the National Guard level either.
I could ask you a question about that, and this might be for Sergeant Jocks. Do we have a systematic way of touching base with people, with everybody, once they come back?
Mr. Chair, when they get back, we debrief them, but quite frankly, it might be from 10 to 2 o'clock in the morning a lot of times. So a lot of times it might go in one ear and out the other. We attend the family briefings, and that's, quite frankly, the little lady's going to tell them what's going on when they get back, because these guys coming back, they're really not thinking about anything but getting home to their families. Their families are back here, and you know, they're kind of the foundation once they get home, and they're the ones picking up a lot of this. The young single soldiers, you just have to go and touch bases with the units. And that's one thing I didn't talk about on here is outreach. I try and stay on the road 2 to 3 days a week, just going to the units. And every unit I go to, it's like a little mini reunion. And I'll talk to them for a little bit. And a lot of times, most of the time, I'll get pulled off to the side. Hey, Sergeant Jocks, I'm mad all the time, and I don't know why. Well, here's some subject matter experts for you to talk to. And then I have them on the radar after that, and I can do welfare checks. But and no matter where I go, that always happens. And every day I learn something new. So it's a long process.
And do you feel like we're reaching every single returning soldier in that regard? I mean,
Mr. Chair, I'll be honest with you. No, we're not. We're trying our best to do that, but there's going to be people who are going to slide through the cracks with the way we have it now. I really don't know how we could do it and get every soldier to go to the VA, but we can brief every soldier. But it's the timing thing that gets, and that goes with the 10-day DMOB. If we had that, it'd be a lot better, because the soldiers would actually get a grasp of what you're telling them, instead of flying for 36 hours or whatever it is now, and getting it right when you get off the plane, literally getting a briefing, which is, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. It's common sense, but we give that, and it sinks in a few of the guys.
Okay. Well, as we keep talking about this, maybe if the committee over the next couple of days decides that it's a good idea, we might ask you to come back with a second policy option if you think that, you know, there are ways that we could enhance what we're doing now. But let's hear the rest of the testimony.
Mr. Chair, just a question. How much interaction do you do with the family resource group, those groups that that I know that exist to make certain that they're communicating with the individual when they are abroad, when they're in Afghanistan and Iraq, and it's mothers and wives and others who are left back here at home who formed organizations? How interactive are you with them so that they can become another support system through the reintegration process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we actually do, we work quite closely with the family programs. We do the debriefs with them, which we have a number of them coming up on the next few weekends. Also, when it's a family issue, I talk to, let's say, Darcy Woodkey in Eugene. And if it's a soldier issue, a lot of times she'll give me a call. So she stays along the lines and does, she's a subject matter expert you know, like Ms. Gooding, also the family subject matter expert. I'm a soldier subject matter expert, and I'm always learning, though. But I stay in that lane. She stays in that lane. And when she comes across something, one of the husbands, I've gotten quite a few calls from the family support group, from wives calling the family readiness group and saying, hey, my husband's just acting weird, and Sergeant Jocks, could you give him a call and see what's going on? And usually we'll go have a coffee or something, and we'll try and get to the bottom of it, and I'll give him the information he needs to be successful. And a big thing with this that I've noticed in talking to the subject matter experts, they have to want to help themselves. There's really nothing we can do for them unless they want to do that. But for those who do want to help themselves, we have to have every asset ready there for them. And that's what we provide.
And conveniently provided, not...
Thank you.
Driving from Ontario to Portland, right? Yeah. Okay. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, Colonel McRae. Next slide. The next two slides are conclusion slides, so, I mean, I can really go through them really quickly. It kind of summarizes up some of the things that we have done. It might kind of get easily past this, but having 237 jobs for our soldiers that were either unemployed or underemployed is a huge deal. And we have just started. I mean, really, we've just started. And we have more jobs and more employers than we have soldiers that will take them. We just have to convince some of our soldiers, that there are better jobs out there, or that there are, in fact, jobs out there. So that's what we're working. The timeline's so short, we don't get to every soldier. However, we're getting better at it, and the word is getting around. And so we're making a lot more contact, and we're still fairly new, only at 2 years old, and working the deployments back. So we continue to get better. We're working with National Guard Bureau to federalize this program. Oregon is the only one that has the program we have, and they're actually used us for a template for the national program, and they're working at some federal funding to do this. And then post-traumatic stress disorder, I'd personally kind of like to hand that off to Dr. Sardo, because he's an expert on it, and we work so close with the VA. They've been a great supporter of us.
Great. Yes, Dr. Sardo, if you could please come forward.
I know. Here, you get the center seat. Can we stay up here?
However you'd like to.
I'll let Dr. Sardo. He's a big man and can take it.
Dr. Sardo, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee. Let me introduce myself. I'm a clinical psychologist with the Portland VA Medical Center. I currently work as the program director for PTSD services and as the program manager for the substance abuse treatment program. Just a couple of comments up front. Number one, whatever money is spent on the reintegration team by the state, it's my clear belief that dividends will be paid back to the state for many years to come. I've had the privilege of serving veterans. I think the oldest vet I've served is 92. He's a World War II vet, and the youngest was 19 and still in uniform. And the number of times I've heard that the genesis of a long-term problem that we ended up providing care for in the VA began when that soldier took off that uniform for the last time and tried to step into civilian life is inestimable. I can't count how many times. The reintegration team has been phenomenal in minimizing those poor handoffs, those times when soldiers just didn't make it into us for too many years, and the problems became entrenched and difficult to treat. It's you know, bending the twig rather than trying to pull down a whole tree years down the road. And folks like Sergeant Jocks, Lieutenant Wood, Colonel McRae, everybody on the reintegration team has just been marvelous. The other thing I wanted to say about the reintegration team is that it is a great concept. It's a great idea that has been resourced with amazing people, and that I believe firmly that the individuals who have been tasked with this with these jobs have been in no small part responsible for the tremendous success of this program. I, as a psychologist, as a program manager for the VA, I've simply come to take it when I get a call from the reintegration team. You know, I don't question it. I follow up wherever they point me because they have never led me down a blind alley. It was never an unnecessary call. The soldiers have always been those who needed the help now, and it's been a pleasure and a privilege to work with the Oregon National Guard on this. Let me talk to you a little bit about post-traumatic stress disorder. First of all, it's a clinical term. It's a diagnosis that I think needs to be understood in the context of what warriors experience. There are a lot of visible and very obvious things that happen that we do for soldiers to send them over to war. We put them in uniforms. We give them equipment and weapons, and we train them to do all kinds of specialized tasks. And those are very observable from the outside. The things that are much more subtle are the changes that occur once a soldier is stepped foot into a war zone. They are adaptations that are very much essential for survival. They are pre-wired. They are part of who we are as a species to adapt to dangerous and threatening places and events. They include biological changes. Changes in how we respond to the environment, how quickly we respond, and how energetically we respond to even the smallest and most subtle cues and signs of danger. They include changes in how we respond to our own emotional state. If we are overwhelmed by our emotions in a moment of crisis, the training doesn't matter. So the ability to hold emotions at arm's length for as long as need be to get through a crisis or a dangerous moment. There are changes in how our memory works. Literally, the memories of dangerous and traumatic events are laid down differently. They're associated with different brain structures. They are recalled differently with much more intense and vivid emotion, which makes sense in a survival in terms of adaptation, because you want those memories to be vivid. You want your body to react with vigor when you recall those events, because it might save your life the next time. The changes, interestingly, can happen almost immediately in response to a single event or in preparation and living in a dangerous environment. What we've learned in the VA over the years of treating veterans is that the adaptations don't turn off so quickly. And in fact, sometimes for some veterans, they don't turn off at all. And that the legacy of coming home from the war may be very visible. It might be loss of a limb or eyesight or scars or some chronic pain condition, joints. But they can also be very subtle. A recurrent, very vivid, very emotional recollections of certain events that can be almost disabling in their intensity and frequency. They can be a pattern of responding to the environment that you become so vigilant for even the smallest signs of danger that your life becomes moving from one potential threat to the next, which makes transitioning back home to being with a family and going to ball games and working and relaxing a significant challenge. Holding emotions at arm's length becomes something that's hard to turn off. Although it was very adaptive in a war zone, in a marriage, it's very troubling. If you live among the lions, does it make sense to be a sound sleeper? No. And our veterans come back, and even the smallest of things, like a good night's rest after a hard day's work, become precious and all too often rare things. Again, adaptive in a war zone, but at home when you're trying to manage Little League, a 40, 50-hour-a-week job, sustaining a relationship with a spouse or loved one, not being able to sleep, it seems like a small thing becomes a huge barrier. At the VA, our job is to work with folks in helping them kind of step back into the civilian world and to step out of those adaptations. We can never undo them because we can never be other than what we are. And the veterans that have served in a war zone come back with those changes more or less ingrained in a lot of different ways. And what is probably most humbling as a provider for me at the VA is that almost to a man and woman, they are ready to go back again and carry on if asked to or required to. I wanted to take, and I'll make sure I allow time to respond to your questions as well and make sure you have a chance to ask anything you need to.
I just have a comment.
Senator Winters.
I'm glad that we do have reintegration program in Oregon, and also, too, that we recognized post-traumatic stress disorder to begin to work on it. I was sitting as you were talking, recalling when my brother returned from Korea. We did not have the reintegration or any of the services that we're currently talking about, and as a family trying to address those issues and emotion, that it's what you're doing today is long overdue and laudable.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Parker.
This, you know, your program is wonderful. I don't know what else to call it. I got out of the military just prior to Vietnam really taking off, so a lot of my friends were Vietnam vets, came home. There was no homecoming because they didn't come home at once. I mean, they were scattered all over. But I work with people. I'm a retired port and police officer, and I work with one guy who got into some trouble, and we had him, I was active in the union, we had him evaluated, and they said he had huge psychological problems. He'd been overrun during the Tet Offensive, ran out of ammunition, and had to kill a guy with an entrenching tool. But I don't know if he ever got treatment or not. He, you know, went on, but and another kid that worked in there was actually the machine gunner in Lieutenant Calley's platoon, Milai, who refused to shoot the women and children. But he was suffering. He didn't stay with the police. I don't know what ever happened to him. We had so many people that were lost, and that came home from that event. And even though there was probably 8 out of the 10 people were really the tail, the supply people, not the teeth. But, you know, huge numbers of people in post-traumatic stress wasn't recognized at the time, and even working with the police later on, we got into that, and we quickly learned that the sooner you get somebody treated, you can actually get a lot done. If you delay it, it just really compounds it. I'm just amazed at this program that you set up in General Caldwell and General Reese, and it's just great. You're saving, I mean, I can't emphasize how much you're saving human terms. You're just saving these people who otherwise would end up, you know, the drunks and in prison and so on. And a lot of them are going to have very successful lives due to your intervention. And it's just great.
Well put. Thanks. And Representative Barker has been doing a lot of heavy lifting on his committee at Veterans Affairs, trying to also make sure that that's not just from Operation Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom, but other conflicts as well are well taken care of. We appreciate that. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment to make, and I don't know if anyone from the Department or the National Guard might want to respond at some point. This program, I will just echo, you know, all the comments, the positive comments that have been made by my colleagues. And it's obvious that this is a very specialized kind of program that belongs via the military department through in the National Guard. I don't mean to suggest anything otherwise. My question or comment is that this is so important and so critical to the state, and I'm very pleased that we have state money going into it, that I wonder if you receive any technical assistance or cooperation or resources, substantial resources, from other parts of state or local government, because it's clear to me that without the existence of this program, there would be adverse impacts on programs that we fund through the Department of Human Services and in local and state public safety and criminal justice system programs, that this program is so critical to helping people, but it also really relieves additional burdens that we would see in other areas if it weren't for your good work.
Would you like to comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, Colonel McRae, what we have found through our work, the networking is our most important piece. We have found that there are a lot of technical experts out there. There are a lot of the VA works, the mental health issues. We have a lot of pro bono organizations for mental health throughout the state. We have county services. What we're able to do is that we're right now, we believe the technical services are out there. Our biggest issue and our biggest goal is to get our soldiers connected to something that already exists. We don't want to try to duplicate somebody's work, because we find that there are a lot of organizations that are already duplicating, you know, something that somebody else does, and our job is to sort out who the best person at a phone number at a desk to call to get our soldier to. And so we believe that the technical expertise is there. It exists in some organization. When we do the summits and we work with the ODVA and the VA and Employment Division and Department of Labor, is we can now pick up the phone and call a person that has that expertise and get our soldier in touch with them. And so that's the benefit that we provide. We aren't very, I'm not very smart at what I do, but we can find people that are smart at what they do. So we believe we don't want to duplicate other technical services that are already there. And so we use what's available, and we have state and federal agencies that do that for us.
Great. Director Willis, did you want to comment on that as well?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I do want to comment on how broad this program really is, beginning with the great idea that came out of the Oregon Military Department to do a better job on integrating these soldier citizens back into the community when they came back from these very hot shooting wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and other deployments that they have done, including Guantanamo Bay. The example I could give you that you may not be aware of is the volunteerism from the Oregon State Bar. They have a group of pro bono lawyers around the state of Oregon who have stepped forward and said, we will help these soldiers and their families with legal issues that may be confronting them before, during, or after deployment. And so the state bar should be applauded for that, because those kinds of issues create great stress in a young military marriage, especially when they're apart from one another. So that's a group that's been helpful. And at the summits, without going through the entire list of everybody who comes to those summits every 4 to 6 months, state employment has been a big player. DHS has been to those summits and been helpful. Certainly the federal VA on both the claims and compensation side of the shop and health care have been there from the beginning. And then, of course, the county veteran service folks, which cover 34 of the 36 counties, have played a role in assisting soldiers in rural Oregon, suburban and metro as well, in addition to the veteran service officers that work for me and the ones that work for the national service organizations. So it's a network of people who probably better understand what needs to be done, but are willing to meet every 4 to 6 months to say, where are the gaps and how can we do it better? And I want to give you an example of one of the things that we came up with. Over the last 18 months or so, General Caldwell and General Reeves and I and others said, who is not up to speed on PTSD? And one of the groups that we discovered was the public safety community. And when I say that, I'm talking about the first responders. Now, Representative Barker and I both come from a law enforcement career. We understand about PTSD because we saw it in police officers. It's also prevalent in that career field because the same challenges occur over long periods of time that do to our soldiers, just from a different source. Now, what happened was we said, okay, how do we do this? So what we've done, and this is a project that's in the work right now today, we went to the Attorney General, Hardy Meyer, And of course the Oregon Military Department, we went to the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training that trains every one of those public safety career fields. And we said, okay, we need to have entry-level people who are EMT responders, firefighters, police officers at every level, and 911 telecommunications staff understand the basic symptoms that are associated with PTSD and how it is acted out physically. Then we also need to make sure that that's a component piece beyond the basic academy as part of the first line supervisors course, and then we need to do what's called roll call training, which allows us to send a CD or something out to every department in the state, play 15 minutes, they get it, they understand what the issue is. And then we do the referral numbers, those same 800 numbers that you saw on those little magnets that you have, would go then to every officer in the state to say, okay, how can I help this soldier, sailor, airman, or marine who's come back from combat and needs some assistance? This is how you do it. First you recognize it, then you know where the resource is. And it's important that I point out that nothing about the program is intended to excuse criminal behavior. That behavior has to be dealt with. But if it's an issue where there's an argument at the home, what we used to call a family beef, domestic disturbance, and it's, nobody's going to go to jail, but something needs to be done, and now you see you're dealing with a person returning from the war. Now the officer has the training to know where the resource is, and the whole idea here is not to make an arrest. The whole idea is to recover the human being and make them whole again. And that's why this reintegration team has been so successful. They've identified what the issues are. They've used people who are combat veterans to staff this, and combat veterans will talk to other combat veterans. It's the old been there, done that syndrome. And that's why they're so successful, and I want to tell you, my staff and I just feel great satisfaction in working with this team. And I applaud the legislature for publicly funding this effort. It is absolutely by itself in the nation, and I know that by talking to my fellow state directors from across the country who have asked for copies of how we do it. And we do it not because anybody's worried about the credit for the outcome. We do it because it's the right thing to do. So each time it's going to get better and better, and I just applaud all the way from the Adjutant General down to the newest enlistee. We have a great guard program, both Air and Army Guard, and they're taking care of their people, and it's our privilege to help them do that. And I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone might have.
Thank you, Director Willis. I think we too are very proud of the work that you're doing and want to make sure that it's funded at the level that you all need. Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Is there any way that, I mean, you know that one out of five coming back is going to have some sort of disorder. Is there any way to sort of create a risk profile or anything like that? Is that a possibility, or is it you just react to certain circumstances?
I think the easiest answer to that has to do with how much they were exposed to while deployed. And that seems to be the best indicator of what we can expect when we get back. And here again, the reintegration team, even from in 2005, we're calling or saying, hey, this group that's coming home, we already know 75 names, right? These platoons, this company, they were exposed to some things, and we're going to be ready when they hit the ground. Can you be at this armory? And again, just very proactive, doing a great job with that.
And Dr. Sardo, I think it's certainly the impression of those of us on the committee that the rural areas of the state have been carrying more than their proportion of the burden in Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. I know that there are VA hospitals in a couple locations around the state, but what happens when somebody calls up from Christmas Valley or, Burns or wherever, and the closest therapist is hours away? How do we deal with that?
Yeah, that's a big challenge. And one, I think the VA, when you look at a lot of the enhancement money that's being proposed, is how do we provide rural health care to our veterans who are dispersed in places like you mentioned. Telepsychiatry is being looked at real seriously because a lot of vets one, because of their work and their need to provide income, they can't come to one of our residential or inpatient programs for treatment. And two, because of the distance involved. I mean, they just can't commute, and there are no providers. So telepsychiatry is becoming something that we're really exploring vigorously. In Portland, for example, we just got approved for a significant enhancement of our telepsychiatry presence, and that'll put even some of our smallest clinics and vet centers will have these kinds of stations where a veteran can come in. They can do, using kind of the video teleconferencing equipment, do therapy in a remote way for part of their care, and then come in for other parts of their care, reducing how much they're having to drive. But it does it does remain one of our biggest challenges.
Can I just follow up? If you could wave a magic wand and money was no option, I mean, what would that service look like from your point of view when that person calls from Christmas Valley to get them the therapy that they needed on the spot,
I think
perhaps in their hometown?
I think the easiest thing would be contract care from the VA standpoint. We have a fairly decent network of community-based outpatient clinics, but even those are in fairly decent-sized communities. Vancouver, Salem, Eugene, places like that. But the real small towns, I think, are really only going to be effectively served by having providers that we can provide training for, who are then will be on contract with the Veterans Administration.
Okay. And could they? Do you anticipate, a social worker being on the road 5 days out of the week, traveling to places? Is that possible?
That's a possibility, and I think I would like to see something like that augment a contract program. I think a social worker like that would be accessible to a veteran in one community, maybe every couple of weeks, and for some of our veterans, that's not enough. Hmm. And while having that kind of continuity to connect them to the mothership in Portland, to handle things like med issues, paperwork, I've got a radiology appointment that keeps getting postponed, and I need to get this in. Having a contract provider that is there to provide the kind of support as needed is really important.
Great. And colleagues, we're running out of time, but so I wanted to continue on, make sure everybody gets heard. If some folks can stick around, I think I can't imagine a more important topic for us to go over.
Yeah, just a quick question on follow up on your telepsychiatry. Because I know that Dr. Norwood Richardson from OSHU is working very vigorously on trying to get telepsychiatry into our rural communities. Are you working with him, or is the VA working with OSHU to try to jointly work together in order to make this a reality?
I'm not on that, not that I'm aware of on that particular issue. We have a number of joint ventures with OHSU in a couple of areas. Neuropsychology, for example, with traumatic brain injury being such a large and prevalent issue right now, we have really worked to integrate our neuropsychology training and staffing with the OHSC, which has had a well-established program for many years.
I was just thinking in terms of whether, so that we don't duplicate efforts, right. If OSHU is, in the process of trying to make this a reality, and if we could even look at their budget to see if there is a possibility of resources in order to make certain that veterans are being taken care of. I think that's something we should follow up on.
Yeah, maybe we can have some discussions with the Health Committee.
Mr. Chair, if I just very briefly, too, we're working on a bill today in Veterans Affairs to make it financially easier for doctors to become involved in the program. I shouldn't say doctors, healthcare providers, especially in rural areas. So those are important things.
And a good pitch to the federal government that they can do a much better job on their reimbursement rates.
Yeah.
With the TRICARE and Medicare and Medicaid. Oregon is at an extreme disadvantage. We've done a good job of holding down costs, and as a result of holding down costs, we've been penalized. And so our reimbursement rates are a lot less than what they should be, and that's the result of why doctors are not taking our patients. So I'd like to encourage us to talk to our congressional delegation.
Another possibility might be for doctors who we give a subsidy for their liability insurance, that they would be required to take TRICARE also.
Mr. Chair, may I just comment that I appreciate very much what Senator Winters just said, because several members of our federal delegation will be here next week in several different geographic locations around Oregon talking about veterans issues, two of the key ones will be rural health care, and the other is the mental health issues. And so if I could just close my part of this by making one statement. Our goal here, and I've seen it with the integration team, and you heard it when they talked about how they're constructed and where they're stationed. Our goal is to make sure that no veteran or no Guard member in Oregon is penalized in terms of the quality of service that they need based on the geographic choice of their residence. And if we focus on that, we will solve that. I'm absolutely convinced of that. And so people should be able to live where they want to, but not be penalized because they're far away from a med center or something. And some of the ideas that Dr. Sardo was talking about is how we're going to solve some of that. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Director Wiltz. All right. Dr. Sardo, did you have any other comments?
I did have one comment to add. I know the statistic 1 in 5 was mentioned recently. I think it's important to note that the state of Oregon is represented heavily by infantrymen. And when you look at statistics like 1 in 5, they tend to aggregate the data across all logistical support troops and just kind of the variety of folks who serve in country. But in the state of Oregon, we have a strong infantry presence, and that means that they're going to have more exposure statistically. When you look at fiscal year 2006, for example, in Portland, we had about 1,200 OIF, OEF veterans hit our system in Portland out of about 50,000 veterans that we provided services for. 45% of those folks had at least one mental health visit in fiscal year 2006, and the majority of them had 10 visits. So we're looking at rates closer to 1 in 2 coming back requesting some kind of mental health services.
Very daunting statistic. We thank you very much for your work, and if please don't hesitate to contact any of us if we can help further it. Is there any more invited testimony, or are we ready to go into the public testimony, or would you like to close?
Mr. Chair, Colonel McCray, one thing that we work closely with the VA, and I think maybe we see more of our soldiers seeking mental health care because we encourage them to do it to get healed quickly, as opposed to 3 years, 5 years, 20 years down the road, still dealing with mental health issues. And so General Reese has made the atmosphere. It's just tried to take away the stigma of seeking, you know, counseling from somebody. So our approach is get it early, because you're either going to pay me now or you're going to pay me later, and it's going to cost a lot more later. And so we've been very proactive on trying to get that done, so we get them healed, so the soldier is back to being a fully capable citizen warrior again and not struggling with their own issues. But anyway, thank you for your time here.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming forward with this very important presentation. At this time, we'll invite up the public testimony colleagues. I'm also excited that first on our list will be someone from the Washington County Veterans Unit who's working with Pacific University on a PTSD counseling project. So, Doug McElvin, if you could please come forward.
Thank you, Chair Shields and committee members. My name is Doug McElvin. I'm the CVSO, or County Veteran Service Officer for Washington County. Our work is representing veterans in the federal VA claims process. But today I just wanted to mention a new PTSD counseling program for Washington County veterans and their families. The program has arisen from an agreement between Washington County and Pacific University, particularly Pacific University's Iris Clinic, which is a community mental health clinic. We have the greatest respect for the Portland VA Medical Center, the PTSD work they do, the Veterans Center, and I know that Dr. Sardo is truly an exceptional individual. The program that we have started is local in Washington County. Some of our veterans have emotional or physical difficulty in reaching, say, the Vet Center out by the Portland Airport. The program we're starting has flexible hours for people. out of the hundreds of PTSD claims that we assist people with. In our program, we have room for maybe 20 to 25 persons a year. The program, which is just now starting this calendar year, it involves counseling by second-year graduate students under supervision. There's a two-hour intake session and then up to 6 one-hour sessions after that. And if we obtain a PTSD diagnosis, that can help in our VA claims process, or it might be just for counseling. The first 10 veterans we have in the program, and it has been mentioned today that veterans with PTSD, it's all eras. And of the first 10 veterans, we have the conflicts represented are Iraq now, Desert Storm from the 90s, Vietnam, Korea, and World War II. That's all just in the first 10 veterans. And we do file first-time PTSD claims for people in their 20s right through to their 80s. A few months ago, we had a D-Day, World War II D-Day survivor who had never sought help. And he's seeing people now. One thrust that we make in this program is helping families, recognizing families. And just an example, you can I know you had the Oregonian article cited today, but you you can have a veteran who's been married 15, 20 years, may have teenagers at home, goes over to Iraq, comes back, and everything's different. And the veteran gets help, but the family doesn't understand what has happened, why things are different than they were. So it's a limited program, but for the people who have trouble emotionally just getting through Portland out to the vet center or even into the VA medical center, and particularly some of our older vets just have physical difficulties, it's a limited program, but it's something we started, and people in Washington County, the veterans are reacting positively, and we thought it's something important we could start. And as I say, it just started this calendar year.
Great.
I just wanted to let you know that's one small little niche that we're trying to fill.
Yeah, and I appreciate you coming down to bring this to our attention and using our universities as a resource to help address people's problems in their own communities rather than having to get them to a different part of the metropolitan region. So,
thank you. Sure.
Yeah, thank you very much for your work on this, Senator Nelson.
It just seems to me like there's a lot of these potentials for things like this to happen. I was just writing down, we have a teenage mental health counseling service out in Pendleton, and they fly in psychiatrists on occasion, flying from Portland. There's a psychiatrist who lived in Pendleton, moved to Portland, comes back. I mean, wouldn't it be possible to mix these programs together, and maybe there's some help with some of the veterans out in that part of the country, because we don't have very many psychiatrists out in the eastern Oregon. Be looking for solutions like that. It's kind of like what you're doing.
Yeah, I think you're right. And
I need a niche someplace in filling.
Mm-hmm. All right. Chair Shields and Senator Nelson, this is a little niche we're trying to fill in our county. We are a larger county, and we can do something like this. And obviously, in the rural areas, it's harder to reach everybody across the great distances. Yeah. We're just fortunate in our area we have the resources to even start a small program like this.
And I'm sure if you wanted to connect that treatment center up with General Caldwell and the and Director Willis, they'd be more than happy to have conversations
sure.
with them.
Yeah.
Good idea. Great. Thank you very much
thank
for coming
you,
to testify.
Thank you.
Mary Botkin. And is there anybody else who was interested in testifying today? Hello, Ms. Bakken. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here at the request of the Military Department. For the record, Mary Botkin, I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and we are proud to represent the non-uniformed staff in the Military Department. And interestingly enough, our union has more members deployed to Iraq than any other union in the AFL-CIO here in Oregon. We have more members in Eastern Oregon who are currently on active duty in Iraq than any other union in Oregon. And because of that, we are more interested, well, not more interested, but we have a keen interest in making sure that not just the soldiers but their families are well cared for and suffer no economic losses as much as possible. We've been very concerned, and I know that Representative Barker shares our concern with the fact that many families are forced into very uncomfortable economic circumstances when a family member or the key breadwinner of the family is deployed. And I want to remind folks, you know, I love the military, but they tend to be a little male-dominated. We actually have a large number of female staff that are deployed as well. And if you think it's tough for women when the husband is deployed, try Mr. Mom. And it's really hard for men when their wives are deployed and they're left with kids. And so we sort of deal with some of that as well. But that's not why I'm here. I'm here to speak in favor of the budget. I'm here to speak on behalf of the folks that we represent and to say that we have a great working relationship with this agency. We have just finished a major comp study, and you have interspersed in the budget recommended salary adjustments for our non-uniformed staff. We encourage you to fund those completely. We've been working with the department and DAS and all the sort of key players in putting that together. Our folks have been terribly underpaid for a long time, and I would be remiss if I did not also encourage the subcommittee to fully fund the maintenance programs for the armories. Our folks are responsible for maintaining armories that are in pretty sad shape in some cases, and some funding would be good so that we can get these armories up to snuff. Whatever all of you can do for employer incentives, we would encourage you to do so. We have done that in the state government. Our contract holds harmless anybody who is deployed. We use retirees to backfill backfill positions so that there's no sort of unintended job losses. If you're deployed, then you continue to accrue some of your seniority. You're brought back at full status so that you do not have to take a job that you would not have to take otherwise. And we've done that certainly in the Department of Corrections, where most of our folks have been subjected to deployment, but sort of across the board. We have tried to hold all of our military and guard members harmless as much as we can. And I actually think our union has been pretty much on the cutting edge of that in sort of stepping up. We started during Desert Storm. A lot of us in this union are children of the 60s, so we remember what it was like when folks came back from Vietnam. You know, some of my colleagues went there. We weren't deploying women then, but we do now. So we have to sort of accept that things have changed a little bit. And, you know, women need different services when they come home than men do. And I applaud the military department for being on the cutting edge of a lot of the reintegration. And we do what we can to help.
And I think what we heard in the Department of Corrections budget is that, you know, a lot of our public safety agencies, DOC, I think, has 30 or 40 people deployed at any given time. And I can't imagine the challenge, the mental health challenges of coming from a war zone back into a war zone.
Yeah, it's a domestic war zone as opposed to a military war zone.
Right, where you have the same heightened sense of your safety and alert, whether it's,
all the public safety officers have the same problem. And, you know, it's certainly exacerbated all the way around. And, you know, I think that the PTSD alerts that they're doing at DPSST are important. But I cannot stress strongly enough about how important I think mental health training generally for public safety folks is.
Can I ask you a question, Mary? Is there been any, when people do come back to that, I mean, I would think it would be much more stressful to be, you know, essentially on the wall at a prison where, compared to perhaps a job at the dome building. Is there a discussion about trying to move people around?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I don't know.
Is there,
you know, certainly the dome building has not offered to step up and give us any jobs. For transition.
Well,
you know?
I hope you let us know if some of your members are saying, you know, I can't handle the stress of this job anymore, and they're not getting the chance to move to a different place in the department.
I would, you know, I don't know that we've ever opened the door for that discussion, but certainly not because we're not willing to. You know, low, those would be considered light-duty jobs, and there are so few light-duty jobs in the Department of Corrections that it is challenging, and at the risk of being politically incorrect, I will tell you that most of the light-duty jobs are held by management positions, so, you know, it's tough for us to figure out exactly how we would get more of them.
Well, just keep us posted.
Yes. Thank you, sir.
Any questions for Ms. Bakken? We thank you all very much. Would you like to make some closing comments?
Mr. Chair, I apologize. Sergeant Heyer came down. He was injured in Afghanistan, and if you wanted to talk him to talk to you a little bit about the medical process and the community-based healthcare organization process that he's now working under, and he's working with us on the reintegration team because the federal side is funding him and while he's recovering, I'd like to have him. I mean,
yes, absolutely. We would love to hear your testimony.
Give you a present, 5 minute present. And in addition, he is also working with the veterans representative at Portland State University to get a veterans resource center initiated at Portland State University.
Fantastic.
So.
Good afternoon. As the Colonel mentioned, I'm a Sergeant Heyer, and I'd like to thank you for having me here today. Actually, I prepared a speech, but I'll just go ahead and shoot from the hip right now. I was injured in Afghanistan about the middle of last year. My shoulder dislocated and separated my AC joint. So I got sent to Fort Gordon, Georgia, after several trips to Kuwait and then to Germany, and then on into Fort Gordon. While I was there at Fort Gordon, throughout the whole entire time I was going through this whole process, only one individual called me. He's not here today. That's Staff Sergeant Cody. He's the medical liaison for the state of Oregon here. He's the only person that contacted me throughout this whole my whole entire trip, made sure I was okay and everything was being taken care of. He's on the reintegration team. He's currently sick today, so he's not here. While I was in Fort Gordon, Georgia, the reintegration team came and visited, and I'll tell you, I was very honored to have them there and very helpful and thankful that Oregon was the only state that sent anybody, and I'm being honest, and there's a lot of states being represented there in Georgia. We're the only state that sent anybody to visit our troops at these medical holdover facilities. Now, when I was there, I was very surprised to see them, but I was honored at the same time because I could tell them, hey, this is what I've gone through. What do I do now? Where do I go from here? And Sergeant First Class Jocks informed me of what I can do along with some others. And I kept in contact with Sergeant Jocks up until when I got home. Then I started meeting with him regularly and saying, Sergeant Jocks, what is it that I can do? Because so many of you have done so much for me and many of the others that have come back from Operation Enduring Freedom, Iraqi Freedom, and what can I do to help you out? And Sergeant Jocks said, just being here helping me out. And so from there, I'm being on CBHCO. It's allowed me to do some thinking and realize what has been a downfall in American society. Where can we help? Where can I help? And many others to better serve our service members, but not just their service members. We got to remember their family members because they're a key role and they're important to society. And I could tell you know, specifically from my experience, that if it weren't for my wife, life would be a lot harder. And so therefore, I real briefly want to start a Veterans Resource Center on the Portland State University campus. And why I say Portland State is that throughout this whole entire deployment in Afghanistan, a lot of our soldiers are coming from the Portland metropolitan area, but yet there's a lot that are coming from other areas supporting communities like Eugene, Bend, and Corvallis, Albany, so on and so forth. I feel that going through the university system alone is difficult, but being a veteran, nobody knows what you're going through or all these benefits that are available to you, or even if you're a family member of a disabled veteran or someone who was killed in action. And as I'd like to call it, a one-stop shop, and putting it in one place rather than, as many of you know, it's difficult when you go into some areas that they send you from one person to the next person to another person, and that's been a difficult experience, and I don't want to have to see anybody continuously go through that after, you know, experiencing what we have. So that's my idea, and I want to, you know, get that going. And right now I've currently got 35 plus people who are going to be attending that meeting, and as many, the more people the better, but it's going to be happening on April 26th at the Native American Resource Center at Portland State University between 1000 and 1200, or 10 o'clock in the morning to 12 in the afternoon. So that's pretty much what I've been doing, and working in the armories and helping out Colonel McCray. And I want to really say, if any of you guys get the opportunity or women get the opportunity, please do go up to these gentlemen and shake their hand and say thank you very much, because I don't know what I'd do without these guys, and they're very helpful. So thank you. Appreciate the time.
Thank you very much. And could you identify yourself one more time for the
record? My name's Sergeant Benjamin Heier. It's H-I-E-R. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Barker.
When I got out of the Marines, I went to start at Portland State, and Vietnam was just kind of kicking off. And we had the Viking Vets there, Veterans Group, and that was kind of the height of the protest and everything else. And we were able to help guys come back and integrate, just really informative. We didn't have the support, and we did way too much drinking, but we did help people get through this early on. So I don't know if they still have that organization still up or not.
Yes, sir. It's actually changed. It's called the Student Veterans Association. It's run by President Jake Meeks, who is actually going to be graduating. I actually have taken Jake and involved him into this whole process, and he's been a big help, and, you know, he's continuing to this day to help me get this going, because I think two minds are better than one. So.
And just, and when he talked about the difference in geography, we would get our GI checks late every month because, you know, just because, and they weren't very big as they aren't, I mean, equally today. And we needed that money, you know, with families and so on. And somebody called, from our group called back east, and they said, you know, you live in Oregon, too bad. So we called Wayne Morse, who was the biggest critic of the Vietnam War around. We did a conference call, and we started getting our checks on the first after that. He laid down a lot of them, so we were fortunate, man. So.
That's great. Well, Sergeant, we sure do appreciate your work, and Representative Barker and I are both graduates of Portland State, and we would be happy to help in any way, and we'll take into account the date of that meeting. We're not sure that we could be able to make it, but we'll offer any assistance we can.
We can meet on site afterwards, but I can get your email addresses, and you can send a representative. Yeah. That would be perfect.
Great. General Caldwell, would you like to say?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know that the hour is getting late. For the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Oregon Military Department, but I'd just close up by saying that what Sergeant Heier here has been able to tell you is we've had several requests from different community colleges and universities. Clackamas Community College, we met with them here recently. They want to do a similar thing, and I think that from a focal point at our level, we're trying to do as much as we can to help our returning service members. I think you've seen that here today in this presentation. We're very grateful for you to listen to this testimony and hear what we're up to. I think the message that I'll leave you with is that we're continually trying to improve this process. We're continually trying to make it better for the returning guardsmen and any other veteran who comes home. We're very grateful, as General Reese said in the outset, for what the legislature has seen fit to do both last session and this session. I think last session was watershed. And I think this particular legislature's current session is doing similar type work, and we're very, very grateful for that. We won't solve all the problems, but we're going to continue to try to identify them and address them as rapidly and as quickly and as efficiently as we can. I think at the end of the day, Oregon's going to be a better place for that, because we're going to have our people in better shape. And I think that what the young sergeant said was one of the we've never done this before. This is new to us, and we had to learn some things, and we learned them very painfully from responses back from young sergeants as himself. When these folks would get tucked away in a medical treatment facility, and suddenly nobody knew they were there. And part of that was the Army's inability to communicate with the Guard initially. Once we broke that code and figured it out, now we know exactly when somebody leaves country. We know exactly where they are. We track them. I see emails every day about different people who are being tracked through the system. So when they get there, we're aware of it, and we're talking to them, and we're dealing with those issues. Because the worst thing you can do to a young soldier, or an old soldier for that matter, any soldier, stick them in a warehouse and say, we'll talk to you in 2 or 3 weeks, because they've got other issues that are going on with them at the same time. And so that's our goal, that's our effort, and thanks to people like Colonel McCray and his team that we've been able to put together with some very quality people, I think we're meeting that, and we're continuing to strive to get better. So I thank you for your time during this past 4 days and offering and letting us offer our budget up to you and let you make those decisions. So. Thank you very much.
Thank you, General Caldwell. You're making us all in this body very proud of your work and your service. A couple of dates that staff who might be listening to this might want to take note of. On April 5th, the governor and Congresswoman Hooley will be having an event working on some of these same issues in the morning, April 5th. You're having your summit on the 18th, correct?
That is correct. 19th.
Okay. And then Sergeant Hire's event at PSU on April 26th. So we thank you very much for staying over on this very important topic. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.